This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. President Trump was in Cincinnati Wednesday for a speech on rebuilding America's waterways. Kroger has announced plans to build a mixed-use project downtown, which will include the first grocery store the company's had downtown in 48 years. And Cincinnati City Council looks at the city's budget and funding for the second year of the streetcar. Joining us to talk about these and other top stories this week are Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich, WCPO.com transportation and development reporter Pat LaFleur, and WVXU reporter and local host of All Things Considered, Bill Reinhardt. You can join us 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Pat, Chris, and Bill, good to see everybody this afternoon.
Good to see you again,
Thanks
Mark.
For having us.
Back. Happy to be here.
Let's start by talking about President Trump's visit to Cincinnati, which was part of a series of speeches called Infrastructure Week. So, Bill, when he was in Cincinnati, what's he talking about?
Well, he talked about a lot of things, and a couple of those things were infrastructure. He actually first made a few remarks at Lunkin when he landed, didn't he, Chris? Were you there?
I saw those remarks. They were about health care. He was talking about how Obamacare is ruining the country, and he had a few families there that he said had been victims of Obamacare. So, you know, there was as usual with Trump, he covers a variety of topics, many topics, including his election victory in Ohio, which, you know, I hope no one's forgotten about because he does need to mention every time he comes
here. Well,
that
was here. How he opened his speech at Rivertown Marina as well.
My favorite quote was, supposed to be very close. It wasn't close.
It wasn't close.
So, emphasis on waterways, though, I take it, Bill?
And there was some discussion of waterways, talking about the locks, the dam system, how important the Ohio River is. It's within, 250 miles of most of the steel production in the country, and talked a little bit about how much goods and energy transportation is reliant upon the Ohio River. He was actually introduced by Ryan Zinke, the Secretary of Interior, and he got up and said, "Why am I here? You know, it's because."
Zinke said this?
Yeah.
Okay.
He said it's because the Ohio River is very important for moving energy. It's part of the infrastructure for moving energy. You see all the coal, you see some natural gas barges moving up and down. And so that's why I am interested in this. And we heard the same thing from Scott Pruitt, the EPA chief, and from the Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue, who mentioned how important the Ohio River was to moving grain. And not just the Ohio River, other rivers, the Mississippi, the Missouri, a lot of nations' grains are moved down to New Orleans, where they are shipped across the country or around the world.
Well, I also found it interesting that he brought those three particular individuals, given last week's exit from the Paris Accord, given those three's connection to any sort of climate issue, Interior, Agriculture, and the EPA especially.
Well, that was something that he did say later on when he was talking about his actual plan to finance redoing all the infrastructure improvements and upgrades. He said, "We are going to streamline the entire process, but if things are not environmentally friendly, they're not going to get approved." And I think everyone kind of glossed over that. At least I did. It struck me, but I wasn't able to fit it into a story.
Well, and he definitely targeted, interestingly, the not only the steel industry, but the oil industry and coal industry as well, which are not really known for their environmental friendliness.
He was saying coal's on the comeback, I think,
was his
message.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, of course, coal is not on the comeback. Coal is dying a very, slow death because of economic competitors. Natural gas is cheaper to burn. It's a little bit cleaner to burn. And that's kind of been the main driver of these job losses in coal mines that we've seen. They had a barge full of West Virginia coal kind of behind them. But it kind of struck me as a bunch of guys talking about yesterday's energy sources. It's just a very, very strange appearance, because when you talk to the Chamber of Commerce around here, when you talk to business leaders, the one thing that they want to get done on infrastructure is the Brent Spence Bridge. And the president didn't mention it one time. And it was just kind of a very, very strange choice, I think.
That is unusual because that was, his number two priority, I think, when he was campaigning?
Well, there was a list that came out that the White House eventually said wasn't actually official, but the Prince Pence was number two on that list. So I don't know that it's officially ranked as number two, but it's definitely supposedly a top priority.
And one important thing to note was Governor Bevin from Kentucky was there, and he's walking a very, very thin line with the folks in Northern Kentucky who do not want to see tolls on the Brent Spence Bridge and its companion bridge that would be built as a part of this big plan to make the bridge safer and to reduce congestion there. So we're still waiting for the governor of Kentucky to come out with his financing plan for how to do the Brent Spence Bridge. He's talked about it in wide concepts in the past, but we don't yet know what the details are. He told me some months ago that there would not be tolls on the Brent Spence Bridge. And the fact of the matter is President Trump's infrastructure plan, it only puts $200 billion new money into infrastructure, and it expects the private sector and state and local governments.
That's $200 billion over a 10-year period, right?
Right. I mean, yes.
$200 billion each year over a 10-year period? Is that your understanding?
No, $200 billion
period.
Total.
Okay.
Which is not a lot of money, but he expects the rest of the money to come from the private sector and from state and local governments. So then it would be up to them to either come up with the money or raise taxes to come up with the other $800 billion that would be spent as a result of this. And if private business gets involved in infrastructure, they're going to need to make money off of it, and that means tolling. So I don't think it was any accident that Trump didn't mention it, yet it was very strange that he didn't, because the one thing business leaders in this region want is a solution to that problem.
Chris, is tolling the main hang-up in getting this whole
Absolutely.
Project going? Okay.
Yeah, they don't – the folks in Northern Kentucky commute more to Ohio than vice versa, and they feel that they would be unfairly burdened financially by it. They also don't believe the toll will be small. I mean, there's kind of a – the folks who promote tolling say, it'll only be $1 or $2 each time. The folks in Northern Kentucky aren't buying that. And
that adds up.
Yeah, and it does add up. If you take it twice a day, let's say it is $2. That's basically, journalist math coming here, but that's $20 a week, if you spend $2 each way every day of the week. So the thing that we've seen in Louisville with their newly tolled bridges is that traffic on them is way, way down. And we'll see if the finances on that actually work out. But that's something that people are keeping an eye on as well as this Brent Spence discussion continues interminably.
Well, and speaking of Louisville, it struck me that Louisville might have been a better location for Trump's speech about locks and dams.
There actually are locks and dams down there.
Okay. They've got the Markland Locks and Dam down there. And back in 2009, I think it was that those locks failed to open.
Yeah.
And it took about 5 or 6 months for them to fix that problem.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah, something I find amazing is that Trump was out on a barge, wasn't he, when he was giving this speech?
No, he was on the bank. Yeah, he was at the marina.
Okay. But still, he's in a very exposed area, so it must have been a
security nightmare.
Yeah. Thank you, Bill.
Well, the security was tight, and there were police boats, fire boats, helicopter overhead, Secret Service guys everywhere, and probably Secret Service guys we couldn't see over on the other side of the river.
So how much is Trump counting on trade unions to help him get this infrastructure plan through, Chris?
Yeah, I think he's hoping for a lot of help from them. And, trade unions, I think that they have a lot of members who voted for Trump, even though the unions may not have endorsed Trump or may have backed Hillary Clinton. But they're the type of folks who, took a look at Trump and heard a lot of things that they liked about, helping working people out. And so I think that he made a specific point of calling out specific leaders who were there from the trade unions. I don't recall their names off the top of my head, but these are the folks that would get work from this plan, regardless of how it's funded. And, I think that he hopes that those folks in the trade unions help the Democrats in Congress who are in lockstep opposition to nearly everything Trump does, which he mentioned several times during this speech. I think that he hopes that maybe they will help him push along this plan. And senators like our own, in Ohio, Sherrod Brown is a very, very pro-labor Democrat. You know, that I think that they that he hopes that he can convince a guy like Brown to, you know, maybe play ball with him.
Did this speech in Cincinnati help him much, especially since that was the day that Jim Comey's opening remarks were released, and most of the attention that day seemed to be on Comey's remarks as opposed to the president's visit?
Well, I think a lot of the attention came because he named a new FBI director, Ray. What's his first name?
I can't remember.
I can't
but
either.
earlier in the day, he named his new appointee for the FBI director, and I think a lot of the national media were focusing more on that
too,
instead of infrastructure because, well, let's face it, infrastructure is not exactly the sexiest topic around.
Well, and then put that on top of the fact that the Jim Comey statement came out that day too. So
yeah, later in the day.
Yeah.
I think the whole thing was a feather in the wind. I mean, I just don't think
that's a good way to put it.
I don't think that it made. I don't think it did what it was supposed to do, which was divert attention from the FBI director.
And it's Christopher Wray. That's who
Christopher.
It is. Christopher.
Thank
Wray.
You.
Pat, Trump says he'd cut off federal funding for so-called sanctuary cities. Will Cincinnati calling itself a sanctuary city, is that going to have any impact?
Well,
on federal funding for the Brent Spence Bridge.
John Cranley can call Cincinnati a sanctuary city all he wants, but the fact remains that the sheriff's department, which runs the local jail, has also come out saying that they will comply with these federal rules about detaining undocumented immigrants. And so the sanctuary city label is kind of it doesn't hold a lot of water legally. And the other point to that is the Brent Spence Bridge isn't really Cincinnati's problem to deal with. It's more Kentucky's problem to deal with. Kentucky owns the bridge. Cincinnati will definitely be a stakeholder in whatever project gets approved because it will involve some widening of I-75 through Queensgate and West End. So they will have a bit of a stake in it, but Kentucky is way more on the hook than the city of Cincinnati or the state of Ohio as far as the Brent Spence goes. So and then not even to mention that like Chris mentioned before, the federal contribution to this $1 trillion project is only what, like 20%?
Yeah.
of the whole thing. So
the infrastructure plan, you mean?
Right. Yeah, 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 the infrastructure plan, the $1 trillion plan, the federal government is only promising 20% of that. So I'm not really sure how this plan will even change the game for the states of Ohio and Kentucky as far as finding a way to pay for this.
Yeah, Pat makes a really interesting point there. I mean, the state of Ohio and the city and the folks on the Ohio side, they've never fought tolls. They've never had a big problem with them. They've done what they needed to do at the state level to make the tolling go by, you know, the tolling to be in effect, basically. They could really give a rip about it, it seems like. It is the Kentucky side that has both, you know, kind of a major problem there, and the biggest issue, the biggest complaints about the you know, the solution that's at least been out there.
Anybody have any predictions on when the Brent Spence Bridge replacement will actually happen?
2050.
2050.
Sometime before the sun expands, consumes the earth, and turns into a...
So you're not too optimistic on this.
And keep in mind, it's not a replacement. There's a new bridge they're going
to
put right next to the old one. They're going
to
keep using the old one.
And that's an important point that needs to continue to be hammered home, too, because a lot of people think that this is going to be a replacement project, and... that's not the case.
Now they will be able to, I think, make the existing bridge a little bit safer, but they're not going to take it out of service.
Okay. Well, Bill, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Bill Reinhart, WVXU reporter and local host of All Things Considered. And we'll continue our review of local news of the week with Chris Rederick and Pat LaFleur. Jay Hanselman will also join us as we move the conversation to Kroger's announcement of a new downtown store, the continuing discussions on the city budget, and funding for the second year of the streetcar. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. It's our weekly review of news affecting the tri-state area. I'm Mark Haney, along with Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wederick, WCPO.com transportation and development reporter Pat LaFleur, and WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Cincinnati City Council's Budget and Finance Committee held its third and final public hearing this week on the city's next two-year budget. And Jay, at these hearings, what are the major themes that are coming out of these as the public addresses this?
The hearing Wednesday night was probably the one that was the most well attended, and actually 42 people spoke. The first two, when you know that there were 11 at the first one and 10 at the second one.
That's quite an increase.
The third one, you double.
42, that's pretty good.
Yeah. But the major themes were kind of what you expected. Human services funding for neighborhood community councils and neighborhood business districts. And then the hearing Wednesday night, there were several speakers that were there talking about funding for the parks, and that's both operating funds for the park and also money for a lot of the deferred capital needs at the city parks.
Yeah, how is human services, how is it doing in this particular budget in terms of funding?
Harry Black's proposed budget, basically Harry Black, when he went through department budgets, I think he cut everything by 25%. So human services funding was cut by 25%. And then, of course, he submits that to the mayor. The mayor has a chance to make changes. And he actually restored human services funding to, I believe the number is like $3.4 million. And the only argument some are making is to go back to the city's traditional policy that back when Bobby Stern was mayor, they had set up a policy that 1.5% of the total general fund budget, whatever 1.5% of that is devoted to human services. And they haven't done that since like 2004, 2005. And there are some pushing that return to that level. I'm not saying it's possible the council members won't try to put it back in, but if they do, it essentially adds about another $3 million to the budget, and things are already tight to start with.
Yeah. How much manipulating and finagling and whatnot is going to go on between now and the time that we actually have a budget in place?
That's a good question. As far as I know, I've seen no motions from council members. I know at least one council member earlier this week said that he wasn't ready to vote for the budget as it was presented, but gave no indication of what's going to change. They're kind of they can do tinkering, but if they tinker, they're either going to have to find ways to add new money or they're going to have to cut something else. And number one, adding new money is difficult in an election year, and then cutting what could be popular with somebody else is also hard in an election year. So there'll probably be some tinkering, but I from what it sounds like, there's not going to be major tinkering.
Well, it's due at the end of the month, right?
Yeah, it has to be. Well, theoretically, they're supposed to pass it by June the 21st, but they have until June 30th to make a final decision. It has to be done by then.
I've been really surprised by the lack of political gamesmanship, both in the introduction of the budget and any kind of changes. I mean, it's been very, very quiet. You know, it strikes me that Mayor John Cranley has probably done council and himself, frankly, a favor by not. There's no major cuts. There's nothing for people to really scream about, even though they had this $26 million deficit. I mean, I'm not sure the thing is balanced. I think that they've done a lot of moving expenses between funds, and Mayor Cranley and the city manager swear up and down that this thing is structurally balanced. I'm not so sure that it is, but
explain what structurally balanced means.
Basically, structurally balanced means that you are spending the same amount of money that you're taking in revenue. So the expenses equals revenue, and you're not using one-time sources to make the budget balance. And that's what councils in the past, and that's what dinged them with the rating agencies. And that's one point where they got a downgrade along with the problem with the pension fund. But the big thing was, they were keeping the budget balanced, but they were using one-time sources to do it.
One thing that they've done is they've taken expenses that were in the general fund, say, and they've moved them over to, MSD I'm just giving examples of other funds that the city has that's not the general checkbook, right? And by doing so, is that a one-time fund? Well, or one-time source? Well, the MSD fund is going to continue on forever. So technically, I think they can say that they haven't done it. But
technically,
there's only so long that you can do that, and with so many things, and so I think that there's probably.
And I would even make the argument: is there such a thing as a structurally balanced budget? Because last July 1st, okay, the budget was structurally balanced until income tax collections started to tank.
Thank you.
In October, November, December, and have been continuing downward since then. So,
because they're basing this on expectations, right?
And they didn't meet their expectations, and that's why I don't think they're going to have to. I don't think they're going to have to retinker with this year's budget, but they had to significantly reduce revenues for the upcoming budget because they redid their economic forecast for how much revenue they'd have in this next fiscal year.
But let's remember the reason we talk about structurally balanced budgets, because the mayor and some members of council came in.
Charlie Winburn.
came into okay. office this last term, you know, screaming up and down that they are going to be the fiscal stewards and they are going to make this thing balanced and they're going to just, you know, sweep aside the fiscal irresponsibility of the previous administration.
The only thing you do have to give them, though, is they did get rid of the one-time sources for the most part.
Yeah.
That is – but
well, the one-time sources that the previous administration
right.
used, which was selling off parking asset, well, you know, leasing them and those types of things. So, yeah, those are major headline-grabbing type of things. But if they go and exhaust the funds – that are specifically used for other things other than the general fund. Well, that's still a problem for the city in the long term.
And the tinkering too. Clearly, Mayor Cranley, you know, he restored the human services funding. He restored the neighborhood support funding. He got rid of the what was pretty unpopular from the get-go to increase parking citations from parking meter tickets from $45 to $60. Now, still in there is the proposal to boot vehicles that have three or more unpaid parking tickets, and then the
increase in meter rates.
And there were some, there have been some that I think there were four particular neighborhoods that were singled out for a 50-cent increase as opposed to a 25-cent increase. But again, if they take the booting out, if they adjust the meter rates, then that's going to mess with revenue.
Right.
And so then they're going to have to – you have to make an offsetting cut or raise revenue elsewhere to make up if you don't do the booting and you don't do the meter rates.
What about public safety, police and fire in this particular budget?
They were, for the most part, left untouched. I don't remember. There were some slight cuts, but the cuts to police and fire were not significant compared to other departments.
I can't imagine that a Cranley mayoral office would dare do anything drastic to those items.
Which is, you know, from a business perspective, is really, you know, you don't look for efficiencies there. You don't look for, I mean, I saw a fire truck pull into a convenience store today that had, the fire truck was the size of the parking lot. I mean, this goes to the situation where we send a fire crew to every medical call and a fire truck to every medical call when, you know, perhaps an ambulance crew or something like that would suffice. I know there's a whole debate about that, but it seems to me that there's not, you know, public safety, there's not much innovation going on there in terms of the money that they spend.
And you're hearing there was at least one speaker the other night at the hearing talking about public safety, I think, makes up 66% of the general
and growing.
Fund.
Is it that much?
It's 66% of the general fund budget. And basically, you know, if you're holding them harmless for the most part, their share of the general fund budget increases as you reduce the funding for the other departments. And that's part of the thing that was interesting, you know, at the hearings. I don't think we know yet. I still don't see how you cut. I think it was between the revenue, the new revenue and the cuts. I think maybe the cuts totaled $8 million to the other general fund departments. I don't know how you cut $8 million from general fund departments and then you say, but there won't be any impact.
Yeah.
There has to be some sort of impact. And I just don't think we know yet, you know, probably October, November, December, when people are waiting longer for something or something's not getting done, then we're going to know, you know, what those true impacts were.
I asked the city manager about that, and his response was, you know, life's going to be harder for city employees, for certain city employees. And you know, he didn't really go beyond that. I agree with you, though, Jay. I think that, you know, you can see it in something that, you know, stereotypically, you know, something the media only cares about, but the amount of time it takes to fill public records requests, for example, it goes on and on for months and months and months before they respond sometimes. So,
yep.
And the general public ostensibly has the right and does file the same kind of request. So there's not as many people in those departments looking at a thing like that, for example.
So we started at what? It was a $24 million budget gap that they closed for this?
Well, way back, I think in January, the first part of the year, it was like $8 million, $8, $9 million.
And then it ballooned, didn't
then
it?
Then it ballooned, I think, to 13 and then to 25 and then 26. And probably the more ominous thing is they already know going into the next fiscal year, they start with I think it's $19.7 million worth of deficit, just without anything changing. At this point for the next fiscal year, there's a nearly $20 million deficit.
And what's that attributable to, Jay? What's causing that?
The lack of revenues and increasing expenses.
Raises for public employees is in there.
So
a multitude of things.
Multitude of things.
Okay. So what's going to happen to streetcar funding in this particular budget? Because they're going to be setting the funding for the second year of operation.
Well, that was an interesting fight. Well, I don't want to say it's a fight, but sort of.
David Mann got riled up about it.
And this is another one of those government terms that you have to love, OMIGA, which is the agreement between SORTA and the city to manage the streetcar.
What is it? OMIGA,
I think is what it stands for. Don't ask me what those
are. Operations Management Intergovernmental Agreement.
Okay, wait a minute. Pat has an idea here.
I think it's Operations and Management Intergovernment Agreement.
That's close enough.
Something like that.
All I know is OMIGA.
Okay.
But according to the OMIGA, I believe it was in April that SORTA was supposed to have this funding request
by April 30th
to the city, and they got it to the city last week. And the reasoning, they said they wanted more good data on ridership, a couple of months of more ridership numbers before they submitted this budget request. But then when they, from near as I can understand, when they submitted it, basically, they only submitted SORTA's numbers. So it had SORTA's expenses, revenue that comes through SORTA, but it did not include any of the city's revenues. So it looked like it had this huge gap in funding, and it looked like it was going to be this
huge— And that's
huge,
not the case.
And that's not the case. And that's what David Mann got so upset about. It's like, you know, if you're going to present this, at least present it so that it's understandable to him as a council member and to the public.
Well— putting aside the fact that David Mann just seems kind of confused about streetcar things just in general, they left out the city revenue for sure, and that definitely made it look like there was a huge deficit that was about to
hit the streetcar,
right. And then you know, they finally got those numbers, and it turned out to be what, like a 40 or so thousand surplus,
yeah,
that is coming up in the next year, based on the request from SORTA, which has yet to be approved in the budget, of course.
Let's see, from the article that Sharon Coolidge did in the Cincinnati Inquirer, $45,523 surplus, Pat, is what would be the actual figures. Revenue is expected to come in at $4.2 million during 2018. And they're asking for, $4.19 million to run the streetcar.
There should be a little bit of, right now the city's operating fund, I think, as of the end of April, I think they had like $172,000 surplus. So there'll be a little bit of carryover for that. But the interesting thing, I think, will be to see SORTA in this funding request has now made the ridership, I believe— the original budget was based on, I think it was 88,000 riders a month forever,
right.
Each month. It didn't matter what month it was. And now they're trying to make the new budget based on more seasonal ridership. So it'll have higher numbers in the summer months, less riders per month in the winter months. And their estimate should be a little bit more based on what's actually happening, as opposed to the first year budget, they had no idea because they had nothing to base it on. They just had to take an educated guess.
And that's been their message about ridership all along, is that it is going to be seasonally impacted, and they don't have any way to read the trends until at least a year through the system's operation.
It would also help if they would competently manage it. Like,
true.
They don't have the traffic study that was promised in December that would be done at the beginning of the year. So we still have a situation where the downtown traffic system is not optimized for pedestrians, buses, streetcars, et cetera. That's just been dragged on forever.
Well, it's been since 1995, I think, that they've conducted the last study.
Right. You know, I saw a real-time arrival sign that didn't work again yesterday.
Well,
the other day.
That's another question. How are they doing on that whole issue of real-time arrival? Is that improving?
I think it's kind of hit or miss.
Yeah, it's touch and go for sure.
I feel like most of the time it works now, but, you know, when I'm walking by and I don't see the thing, I'm like, oh, you know, I mean, come on.
It is going to be interesting. Normally, all the streetcar matters go to the Major Transportation and Regional Cooperation Committee. I think I got all those terms in there. But actually, the SORTA funding request for the streetcar is going to be considered at a special Budget and Finance Committee meeting on Thursday. And that is chaired by Councilmember Winburn. And Councilmember Winburn is obviously no fan of the streetcar. So there will be some grandstanding publicly and speechifying. But one would assume that that the funding request – now, the city said they did have some questions. There'll probably be maybe some slight changes, but it'll be approved. I think the interesting – I don't know what the other two think about this, but I'm wondering – at what point do we hear that maybe they're going to start scaling back the weekday operation, perhaps Monday through Friday schedule, since it seems that most of the ridership tends to be on Saturday and Sunday?
Well, I mean, the thing's running until midnight on Monday through Thursday, right, Pat?
Yeah.
I don't know that it needs to do that, although you have red season. I mean, that's another thing. Maybe they need to run it till 11:30 during the Reds
games. I was wondering maybe if there was a plan where maybe it would start like 9 or 10 o'clock weekday mornings instead of 6:30 in the morning. Yeah.
Until it becomes a real commuter tool, right? And that's probably not going to happen until it gets expanded, at least up to Clifton. The weekday ridership is going to remain lower than the weekend ridership, and that's or Reds game day ridership or what have you. So they're going to have to adjust the weekday schedule, I think, if they want to make sure that this thing operates properly.
I just wonder if they can ever meet their headways if it's running with downtown traffic without being a dedicated streetcar-only lane, that's the only thing that can run.
Well, that would
that
be
lane.
The dream, right?
I mean, let's see what the traffic study actually does. I mean, I was in the Ted Torbeck, who's the CEO or chairman of Cincinnati Bell now, and he had his committee meeting yesterday, and basically they said that the traffic study wouldn't be done till the end of the year or later. We're gonna have a full year under our belt without this thing, being really run the way that it should have run.
I didn't get to do yesterday's hearing, but I've done a couple of those. If there's any hope that the streetcar is going to work, it could be because of Ted Torbeck, because he's kind of no nonsense, especially dealing with bureaucrats when they'll start through their major list like no, I need one or two things, I don't need 10 things, I need a couple of things, and we need to focus on those two things.
Councilmember Simpson pointed this out in an interview I did with her, and it is just really, really sad that the city, SORTA, TransDev, and the manufacturer, I guess, of the streetcar, those four parties, that they have to have this guy whose job it is to run a major, I don't know how much his company brings in revenue, but it's in the hundreds of millions, that they have to have this guy sit down and tell them how to do their jobs. I mean, it's really kind of outrageous.
But for somebody, and if you deal with enough politicians, it's kind of refreshing. It's like, because he cuts to the chase. It's like, no, I need this,
But it's important to note, this isn't happening in Kansas City. The CEO of the phone company in Kansas City is not running the streetcar meetings there. And that's because we don't have a political leadership who is really interested in this thing working the way that it should. And it's a sad situation. It's kind of what you would expect, though. Mayor Cranley didn't have any interest in this thing, coming in, and the city council overruled him. So the political circumstances are such that this is a project without a champion in either the mayor's office or really the city manager's office.
Well, and that's a point that transit advocates in the area hammer home over and over again, is how important local leadership is in making projects like this work functionally. So you make a good point there that not having a champion in City Hall who's in a position to really drive success is a major obstacle for the streetcar.
Right.
We will continue our conversation. You can join us 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining us this afternoon, Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wederick, WCPO.com transportation and development reporter Pat LaFleur, and WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. You can join us 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Now, Kroger announced plans to open its first downtown supermarket in 48 years.
Where is this going to be located, Chris?
It's going to be at Central Parkway and Walnut Street. So it's just right down the block from Kroger's headquarters on Central Parkway. You know, this is just kind of a huge deal for the city and downtown in general, because there hasn't been a downtown grocery store for at least 40 years. I think it's more like 45. Kroger will close the Vine Street over the Rhine Kroger, which is a kind of a tiny store. It doesn't have the product range you would expect to find at any other Kroger store in the region. And so this new Kroger store, it's going to be a pretty pretty modern store. It's going to be two levels. There'll be what they call a food hall on the first floor.
How many square feet, Chris?
45,000 okay. square feet. So it's smaller than your Kroger Marketplace. I mean, they're not going to be selling you coats and underwear and stuff there, but it'll just be focused on food.
Isn't that a parking lot right now, that location?
It is. It's a vacant parking lot.
It's kind of a dead zone over there.
Court Street's pretty active, but facing Central Parkway, it's definitely nothing going on there. It's right next to the Hamilton County Administration Building, so it's
right on the streetcar line,
right? And it's not just a grocery store; it's an 18-story tower. It's going to have 550 parking spaces, more than I think it's close to about 130 apartments. So it's a mixed use tower, and it fills in a huge parking lot there. And so that it does a lot of things other than just provide a place to, you know, buy groceries. The folks at the city and the business community think it helps meld together over the Rhine and downtown even more, because people are going to come from both places to shop at the new store. It's right on the streetcar line. There's a stop right in front of the building. So it's going to provide easy access for people who might be 10 blocks away at the banks but don't want to drive over to the Kroger store. There will be parking set aside for Kroger customers. I think there's about 140 free spaces that they'll have access to. And they really hope that it brings downtown workers as well. There's about 17 and 18,000 people who live in the Basin neighborhoods, being over the Rhine, the Pendleton neighborhood, and downtown. That doesn't include the West End. If you include those folks, brings it up to a little bit over 23,000, 24,000. Grocery stores typically like to see about 20,000 people within the mile or so proximity of them. So Kroger's kind of doing a little bit of a leap of faith here, but they think that it's going to work because of the 70,000 or so people who live down or who work downtown. And, you know, they're going to go to the place for lunch probably. There's going to be a lot of prepared foods. The food hall is going to have local restaurants that offer ready-to-eat meals, and basically everybody is very, very excited about it. I suspect
it's what they're calling the urban format grocery.
Right, yeah. It's an urban format grocery, yeah.
Chris, behind the scenes, because this is Kroger and because right. Kroger is headquartered here, is there any reason to believe that maybe several years ago the Flaherty Collins development at 4th and Race under the Mallory administration, it was supposed to include a small
right.
grocery store, and then when the mayor's changed, the project at 4th and Race changed, and the grocery store disappeared from that project.
Right.
Is there any back channel talks that was done to make sure that this possibility with Kroger was still viable?
You know, you hear chatter. I mean, I have to say, I think it really rises to the level of, you know, a little bit. It's a little conspiratorial. That grocery store that was going to be at 4th and Race was only going to be 15,000 square feet, so it was only going to be a little bit bigger than Over the Rhine Kroger. And the other thing about it was that it was not going to be a named grocery store, right? I'm just trying to think of examples, it wasn't like a Jewel Osco or something from Chicago, or it was going to be a grocery store run by the developer who had no experience running grocery stores. So I think that was the Mallory administration's effort to really force it through. They had this bit, I mean, that was a 30-story tower too. Mayor Cranley downsized that project, or really sought to downsize it. It was Flaherty and Collins ultimately who did the downsizing. He thought it was too rich of a deal at the time, and maybe in 2013 when he was inaugurated it was, but back when the Mallory and City Manager Dahoney folks were crafting it, it was probably 2012 that they started on that project. So downtown was in a different place then. So
how did this deal the specific deal? How did it come together?
It was a two-year process at least, although Kroger has been thinking about this since 2003 when Joe Pickler was the CEO of Kroger. It was an effort by a lot of different parties, mainly the city, Cincinnati Center City Development Corporation, more commonly known as 3CDC, and then three Kroger, of course, and then three real estate developers, North American Properties, North Point Group, and the Rookwood Properties Company. They're the actual owners of the land. And so they brought in the other two real estate developers to help develop the tower that will go with the Kroger and the parking garage. The financing is super complicated and not exactly figured out yet all the way.
What do we know about it at this point?
What we know about it is the city will help pay for the garage and the apartment complex. The city's kicking in $8.5 million for that. Kroger's going to spend, I believe it's a little bit more than $20 million on its store. There's a project tax increment financing district that they'll set aside to help the public infrastructure on that. Kroger will contribute its share to the parking garage of that. And then there's a lot of private financing, and 3CDC will kick in some money from the fund that it has that's funded by the city's largest corporations to move urban development along downtown. So if you go to businesscourier.com, you can read all about the financing if you're interested.
And you're allowed to get that plug in.
CincinnatiBusinessCourier.com.
And I think the goal is council will have to vote on the development agreement and the funding before the summer break, which would be
right.
Like June 28th at the latest.
And then they'll come back in August and vote on some more stuff with it. So,
but you don't see any problems with that happening?
Well, that's what I was going to ask Chris. This came up the other night at the budget hearing. There was one council member was talking about corporate welfare,
mm-hmm.
and another council member mentioned that, you know, maybe it was time to start focusing more on people and less on corporations. So that makes me wonder.
Yeah, let's talk about that.
Normally development agreements are 9-0, but I'm wondering if there could be some no votes on this.
This is an election year, so somebody's probably going to cast a no vote. You know, I heard some people say, "I'm going to vote for this quietly." And the way that the mayor ran into a buzzsaw of opposition up in Clifton when he vetoed the money the city was going to give the Clifton Market Co-op grocery store $400,000 to help it along. The mayor vetoed that out of the budget. And so the way that the way that this project is financed, the city will not give any direct money to Kroger for the grocery store because the mayor does not believe in funding retail or helping fund retail from city taxpayer dollars. So the way that they get city money on this without the mayor running afoul of his principles there is that they give the money to the garage and the apartment tower. And, you know, I remember Councilman Member Simpson saying during the campaign that, I mean, I asked her specifically about a downtown Kroger, and she said that she did not believe that they should get money for it. But she would be happy to fund any grocery store they wanted to open in Avondale or Bond Hill. She just believed that downtown development has come along enough to, you know, to really focus resources elsewhere. So the politics of this are going to be really interesting. I haven't talked to her about this deal since it was made. In this case, if she votes yes, she would be funding a garage and and an apartment tower, not a grocery store downtown.
Because you have to ask who's going to vote against a downtown store, especially right. when you have critics. You have to face critics who say we have food deserts
right.
all over Cincinnati.
Right, right.
And the other thing, too, I think that there's been more and more comments from council members about when basically incentives are used to prime the pump.
Mm-hmm.
to get people to do things. And I think more and more you're hearing some council members say, look, I think we've primed the pump enough for downtown and parts of over the Rhine. Is it time that we start priming the pump in other neighborhoods?
Well, and what about Walnut Hills? You know, their Kroger just closed, and that was a huge thing. And I'm not quite sure what the latest is on that, but speaking of food deserts, Walnut Hills.
I think they're going to prime that pump one more time, Jay. Oh, I think there's going to be five votes for it.
I'm not saying that I think that it's not, but you are hearing with each, if there's a, you know, I think developers have come to expect that they're going to get some sort of tax incentive, tax or some sort of help from the city, especially, you know, I don't know that it's automatic, but you're hearing some council members openly say, you know, maybe it's time to to turn off that spigot and let these folks stand on their own.
And I don't want to shill for the developers because I understand what those council members are saying and tend to agree with it to a certain extent. But the fact of the matter is it is not financially feasible to build a 18-story tower and only use the market for that. It's not, they couldn't get the rent that they needed to. I mean, these apartments alone, they're going to, the biggest ones, which are 1,400 square feet, they're going to go for over $3,000 a month, which is a humongous sum in Cincinnati. But fact of the matter is we have people moving in the city who are from Newark or Chicago or whatever, and they don't bat an eye. And then you have some people who are empty nesters who want to downsize and live in the hip urban place, and so they can afford that as well.
And just what a parking space, to build a parking space in a garage, is it like $20,000-$30,000 a spot?
Yeah.
Wow. Has there been any mention, Chris, of what it will take for Kroger to just to break even?
They were not going to discuss the finance of it. One thing that CEO Rodney McMullen did say to us or to me was that the store will probably do better 5 years after it opens than the day that it opens. So